So I'm Noble Benway, and I'm here with Amy Good, and together we represent the curatorial and the education departments of the Drawing Center. And we're here with Terry Smith, whose exhibition we are surrounded by, and his longtime friend and collaborator, Colm Storey. So I'll just introduce, I think, the project, which has a number of layers, which we'll hopefully get into tonight. So I'll just sort of peel off the first one or two, and then I'll hand it over to the both of you. So we at the Drawing Center have been wanting to work with Terry for some time. We have known about his work and have been interested for a while. And when we learned that the 2013 iteration of the Ideas City Festival, which is a festival which happens every other year, just finished its second iteration this past May, but the theme for this year was going to be Capital Revisited, we immediately thought that that would be a really interesting way to engage with Terry, partly because one of his best-known projects was a project at the British Museum done in 1995 called Capital. Some of you may have read about that or may have seen some images from that. There's one here on the wall, this one that has a sort of a film strip look to it, which was one of a number of projects that Terry has done that involves cutting into the wall. And so that was the original idea, that for the Idea City Festival, which is which involves a number of Lower Manhattan organizations, including the Drawing Center, that we would invite Terry to come and do wall cuts as part of an engagement with the idea of capital. And so that project evolved and evolved and evolved. It took place as a public project, a series of wall and window drawings as part of the Idea City Festival, as I said, in May. And then here, we're exhibiting document, which is a rather sort of blunt way of saying exactly what I think we were trying to do, which is ask the question of what documentation of a public project, of an ephemeral project, can be, or asking the questions associated with that sort of operation. So that's, as I said, a sort of number of complicated layers, some of which we can get into tonight. Colm worked with Terry on the original Capital project at the British Museum, so I'd love to hear about the relationship between the two and the origin of that project, which was quite large scale. So I don't know, Amy, if you have other things to add initially, just this kind of background information.
Yeah, I run education and community programs here at the Drawing Center. And just to kind of place the project in a bit of a history, so in 2006, we started doing projects with the River to River Festival, which were artist-led, site-specific, public participatory collaborations. And we did a number of those over the years. Every year we would do, and they would be cited in places like South Street Seaport area, World Financial Center, out on the plaza and inside. So we were starting to really take the mission of the Drawing Center and sort of extending it through kind of the lens of education, but also with this piece that we are a presenting institution. We have a deep and rooted history in the artist community and the questions that artists are dealing with around drawing. And so that was a great way, so that's sort of that history, is that we've been doing a number of these projects like that. And the Idea City Festival, which Nova mentioned, has been a community-based effort, really led by the new museum, but with the partners of the Drawing Center, Cooper, Union, NYU, the Bowery Poetry Project, and others that I'm now forgetting, so I apologize for that. And the effort really being to look at how creative community shapes the social and civic and engagement in the city, the development of that. So Terry's project was something that we had thought about for a while as a perfect blend, a way to create community, a way to present another piece within, you know, the outside the confines of the institution. So kind of places it. And
Okay. Well, I think we're going to start with talking about the British Museum project.
That's a kind of particular historical perspective, I guess. And how that came about. Actually, I should say one thing before we get going, is that I have a Scottish accent, as you may have noticed. Terry has a London accent. We've talked a lot about whether anybody would understand a word we said.
There's an echo down here, too.
So
if you're in the back and you can't hear, just wave.
Yeah. Raise your hand, and we'll repeat slowly and do an American accent.
We'll do American accents. Yeah, that would be brilliant.
Well, I feel like I could be a good translator.
Okay.
So that's okay.
So if anybody is missing anything along the way, just shout. Okay, so 1995.
Yeah.
In 1995, I was working at the British Museum. I'm an exhibition designer. That's mostly what I do. I write a bit and do other things as well, but that's how I make a living. And I met Terry at an opening of a small show that he had put on. And I kind of jokingly suggested that he might like to make an installation in a gallery that I was working on, which was empty, a big, big neoclassical 19th century gallery in the British Museum, designed by Robert Smirk. I don't know if that name means anything to any of you, but a very kind of legitimate piece of neoclassical architecture. And I said, kind of half jokingly, or no, completely jokingly actually, you should come along to the BM and hack the walls. And he phoned me up, I think the next day, actually. It took me by surprise. And but then there was a kind of long process where we negotiated this abuse of the museum, this taking apart of the walls of the museum. And the first step in this was just establishing that nobody else had any kind of sort of ownership of this length of plaster on the walls. And so we established that. So that then the next stage was to say, okay, so it's all going to be taken off anyway. So could we start the process? Could we get Terry in to start the process? And the first person I asked this, my boss, my direct boss, said, you know, I don't think I can answer this question. I'll have to pass you up the line, up to my boss. And he said, oh, yeah, I suppose that's all right. As long as the British Museum doesn't have to engage in any way with this process. So they said, there's the wall. Get on with it. We won't give you scaffolding. We won't give you any warders, people to look after the space. And actually, we'd rather not allow members of the public in to see it. And to Terry's great credit, when this emerged, he said, okay, I'll make a big piece of work, and it will have existed, but maybe nobody will see it, only we will see it. We kind of, as Terry chipped away on the walls, we chipped away at the institution and got them to agree a bit more each time. It was never huge steps. So we got them first to agree that people could come in as long as, again, nobody had to direct them there or had to look after it. Then we got them to agree that they would sell a postcard of the work. Yeah. That was kind of a major breakthrough. But they'd never agreed to that the work existed for visitors. So if anybody asked about it at the desk and said, I hear there was an art installation, the people working at the desk were told that it didn't exist. They just had to say, don't know anything about that, you know. So if you knew which room it was, room 52, I think.
49. 49,
sorry, I was three out. Then you could go up and see it. And then I think that the final victory was they wouldn't let us have a party or, you know, any sort of opening party. And eventually we got a kind of closing party on a Sunday afternoon with no alcohol, but some...
we bought some, didn't we?
I think we just like, snuck some alcohol. So it was an incredible process. I mean, this is all stuff, this is not about the work, this is just about getting the work into the space. So it was this incredible process of working, you know, behind the scenes, between the cracks in the institution. And it was very interesting for me, because I was employed by the British Museum at the time, to know that you could do that you could actually get, you could work in those tiny fissures in the kind of bureaucracy and make something happen. And so it was really encouraging for me. And I mean, I think it was a kind of quite a big step because it was much bigger in scale than anything you'd done up to that point.
So what was it? What it was, 35 feet by 17 feet. Get an idea of proportions from there. I mean, I had no idea how to do it either. I mean, that's the fun part of the project, was to begin something without any clue how to make this thing this big. So the process of making this was very similar to the process for this project, actually. Mm-hmm. So I had the room 49 as a studio for a month.
So
I spent the first 2 weeks just drawing the Ionic capital, because actually outside the British Museum are columns, and the columns are Ionic capitals. Mm-hmm. I mean, Callum told me what those things were. I didn't know what they were called, so they're called capital.
Yeah.
And of course, I knew that Karl Marx had written Das Kapital in the reading room, or a certain reading room. It seemed like too good a thing to resist. So I began kind of working on the drawings, and the process for me was just simply drawing over and over and over the drawings. So bit by bit, I kind of got the tiny drawings, the slightly bigger drawings, slightly bigger drawings, and eventually the sort of final drawing was about 9 feet long.
Yeah.
And then the problem then was how to make this piece onto the walls, because I didn't know how to do that. And I figured I had to square up the wall. Mm-hmm. And the way to do that would be to use this kind of, I don't know if they use it here, but a kind of loose string. It's a kind of string that you've got chalk on it, and you're kind of holding it, and you're pinging it as it kind of leaves the line. But I didn't want to leave a line on the wall. I didn't want to do that. I kind of wanted, so what I did was I simply sat and looked at that wall, and I had all my drawings around me, and I drew it so many times I could draw it in my sleep. Then I just imagined a piece on the wall. Then when I imagined the wall there, I could go up and make a mark, a tick, and kind of work out where things went. I used a projector once, only to put a spiral, but it was only to get that absolutely right. And it was a wonderful experience to do this, just to play with the drawing and that kind of scale. And then once I made the drawing, then I had to cut through the plaster. And because the Victorians did this thing where they had maybe three or four layers of plaster, there's kind of brick, and there's the bonding plaster.
Was the horsehair plaster?
Yes, horsehair plaster. Yeah. Then the skin plaster, and the final day thin plaster.
Yep.
And then the lathes, the wooden lathes.
No, it didn't have wooden lathes.
Oh, yeah, right.
Because it was against the brick wall.
Yeah.
And in previous projects, before I did this, what Kevin saw was the show at the Evan Gallery, which is an artist-run space in South London. But before that, I worked in some houses in Leytonstone, in East London. And I tried to get permission to work in these buildings because they were being demolished, and they refused permission and said no. And I really hate that word, so I decided that yes was a better word, so I broke into the buildings and made the work anyway. So I went through various buildings down the street and made these installations, cutting through into plaster and through into the plaster. So I'd done some cutting before, and I liked the layers, I liked a lot of the kind of layers. So in a way, I could make a kind of trompe l'oeil piece by kind of using different layers to create different textures, different colour. I got off on a tangent there, I kind of what was. Another thing which I found was that the brickwork had a kind of bloom over it, a kind of white bloom that I think.
Yeah, that would be salt.
Well, I couldn't figure out how to get rid of this because I wanted to kind of cover the plaster.
Yeah.
I mean, we talked about it, and we kind of worked out, and I talked to the conservation department about it, and they didn't know anything about it. But by this point, we were embedded in the we were getting lots of support. Every time we wanted anything, it just arrived, you know.
Yeah.
Scaffolding towers, it wasn't going to get...
But the scaffolding towers, they'd come from the British Museum, actually, in the end.
I mean, no, they were really kind of... Occasionally, people would come around and kind of wonder what we're doing.
How long was that process?
The installation process?
Yeah.
3 or 4 weeks, I think, wasn't it? Yeah.
So 2 weeks of drawing.
And sitting and looking.
Okay. How soon did you start working after that phone call to Calum saying that you really wanted to do it?
Well, February was the show. We started in April, so about a month and a bit, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's about right.
So it's about the same amount of time that you... On some level, I mean, shorter a little bit, but the same amount of time that the project was here.
Yeah, based on the time.
So the project here, just realizing, talking on the layers, that there's a lot of backstory about the public element to this, the idea of City Festival, which involved 5 different sites at the end, I believe. So this one here is maybe the most visible, Ideal Glass, all the sites were in the sort of Bowery neighborhood around the new museum. So this is on 2nd Street, is that right?
East 2nd between the Bowery and 2nd Avenue.
Which is a kind of an art center unto itself. There's an amazing amount of activity that takes place behind that door. and so that's a sort of piece of the Capitol, and other pieces appeared on the back of the La Mama Theater, which is another very historic building right in that neighborhood. Terry was working, we didn't mention this, but Terry was working in the basement of La Mama, another space that was in the middle or on the cusp of renovation because it has been for many years the home of the Millennium Film Workshop, which is a really venerable institution showing experimental film for years and years. And they were sort of moving out, so Terry came in and regenerated that space while it was kind of emptied out. And you can see some images of the studio here, these kind of darker ones. It was a basement space, but it was really vast, and it was kind of a smelly but still ideal place to realize the kind of scale of the drawings that Terry was making. And then those were, so there was also a drawing in that space, and then one on Lapicio Restaurant, and the last one on 1st Street Green, which is directly across from across Houston from the Sarah Roosevelt Park, which is where the festival tents were kind of set up, and then we were there for that. So in this case, the project was Capitol Revisited, but it was also Broken Capitol, and that's a question that I certainly wanted to kind of pose to you, that relationship there. But what you're seeing here are drawings from the project and the kind of way in which, in this big drawing, the Capitol was broken apart and then kind of re-pieced together through these large-scale drawings on these different sites.
Well, the first plan was to remake the Ionic Capitol here. Then when I came in February for a site visit and saw that in front of the drawing center is a Corinthian capital, I thought that's going to be much more interesting, much more complicated object to do, but more interesting to draw. So that became the kind of simpler thing that I worked with. So the process of the studio was, again, it was great for me to kind of rediscover drawing again, because then my practice is, I think of it as drawing, everything I do is drawing, whether it's with dance or whether it's with video or sculpture. Actually, the kind of essence of what I do is drawing, I think. It was great to actually discover drawing again on paper and work again with basic materials. So the process began with just simply, as before, just drawing the capital over and over and over again. I had photographs that I had taken the first time, which I went back to London. I worked in my studio a little bit. And then when I came back here, I spent half a day upstairs on the ladder just looking at the capital and drawing it and trying to see the detail on it. And I was curious about where it came from. I was curious about what the plant was called, which is called a...
Nacanthus.
Nacanthus. And I was also curious about the curly-curly bit, which when I drew the British Museum one, I assumed that it was just simply a parchment. I just didn't think about its origin. Actually, I just thought about it as a physical thing.
Like a scroll, some kind of paper scroll or something.
So I've always assumed that's what it was. And then when I came here, the first thing I did in the city was do 50 drawings of those little ones there. I'm just in E, just going over and over this kind of spiral. And as I did this, it occurred to me that actually it seemed to be more like a horn of a goat or a ram.
Any art historians in the audience that know exactly the origin of the Ionic capital?
Somebody knows this story. Well, I don't know. This, as far as I can tell, this is not proven, but I'm convinced of it because it just looked like that. And then you know, you, the drawing centre maybe again printed up these drawings, these photographs of these horns, and it just seemed to me to make sense that a ram's head would be the thing you'd use to hold up a building. That's the kind of mythology of those things in the Greek time. So I found myself for a month drawing horns and flowers. Which I didn't plan to do.
But it seems to me that you, I could be wrong about this because maybe it was just a different time, but the drawings that you made for this are much more a part of the overall work. I don't have such a recollection of you doing that in the British Museum, because then you seem to be working towards making a piece. And I wondered if that emphasis in your practice has changed over the years, that you now the process has become more important to you than the product, if you want.
Well, I think for the British Museum piece, the work was towards the kind of wall cutting.
That was towards
the wall cutting itself.
Yes, the wall cutting, yeah.
For this project, actually, though it was for a festival, for a four-day thing, the real project, in a way, was a photograph. So I'd always in the back of my head how we would make this photograph so we'd get bits of the column in different parts of the each village, so which could be reassembled as a photograph. So I always had in the back of my head that actually the piece wasn't necessarily the wall pieces, but what would happen once we photographed it and reassembled it.
Yeah.
And that was a different thing from the
And I
think also I followed through the idea of drawing much more here. So this is a drawing on the walls rather than a cut through.
Yeah.
Although we did cut through what we did here, I mean, technically it was interesting, I think, was that we, having to scale things up, we then made the full-scale drawings in the studio on the floor.
Yeah.
And then we took the kind of really pencil drawings up, and they were pasted up by Jason and the crew. Mm-hmm. Onto the walls, so we had a kind of thin papery, a thin pencil marks. And then we had the scaffold tail there, we just went through and kind of carried on drawing, so the drawing process carried on the wall.
I found what was really interesting for me to be involved in this process was I had accounted for a certain percentage of discovery or exploration in your process, and then so I was in my producer head, and then how much of that, I didn't account for the whole discovery process would be what was unfolding, and then at the end, the compression to then the putting the work up and getting it actually out. And so that was really fascinating to, because it goes back to what you're talking about, like that with it sounds like from each of your projects, you take the same approach, like, I'm not sure I know how to do this, but I'm going to take the work that gets framed within that right, that framework of discovering. And you, so I'd go visit you, and you would say, you know, you'd be working, and you were making drawings, and you're finding the form, and you're like back and forth with, can you print that out? Because I need to know where this form is coming from. And your fingers, you kept talking about how you were getting back to, the hand was taking you back into what it was that you needed to figure out about the piece and the scale of it, because the scale piece was really like we all really had to grow with it, which was really fascinating.
The project was great. I mean, I mean, it is, and I like that problem of not knowing.
Yeah.
Of kind of like we're here and we're there, and we're not quite sure how to get there. But we kind of feel like we'll find a way, hopefully, before we get there. There'll be something occur to us to kind of make it work.
Can you talk a little bit about the more abstract works that
you see here, when they were made, and how you sort of thought about them in relation to the project?
Well, the blue tape, which is a thing I think you're quite familiar with here, I'm not familiar with in London. Mm. We have masking tape, which is like a kind of beigey kind of thing, thin. But this blue tape, I just thought it's so wonderful. And actually, today I was walking around MoMA. We get to like Matisse a lot, actually, with this. I felt I kind of was looking at Matisse a little bit. And actually, today, looking at MoMA and the Matisse's there, the blue is very much the same blue. The bathers is that kind of blue. Mm-hmm. So I just love that tape. We're using tape on the floor, we're using tape everywhere. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't help making it into the drawing in some way.
But you know what it's for, that.
Yeah. But it's perfect because...
Well, it's great because it's got that colour.
And I've used tape before, but not quite like this. I just thought, so these bits, what I did here, this series here, and a few more from them also, that series were post-seed. They were post-project. So once I'd finished the project, we had the thing installed, I used blue tape.
No, Terry, I thought those works were when you were still in that process of discovering...
No, it's after. All this was done...
The cutting and the type of paper that you were still trying to figure out what was the right paper to go outside.
No, these are all the day after. Okay. Once I finished the project, I went back in the studio.
Immediately.
So there were lots, there were hundreds of drawings. I just keep looking again. And there's a poem by a Portuguese, poet, whose name I've forgotten.
Pessoa.
I sent you that poem. I have it sending poems in the morning. But this particular poem, he talks about it's about gardens. He says that, he talked about the manicured garden. And that you look at this manicured garden, the flowers look like they're scared of the police. And then he talked about, later on in this poem, about how the first man saw the first flower, and how he stroked his hands along them to see it with his fingers. And I think that's what we do with artists, or we do as people, is we see different ways. We see by touching, we see by moving, by playing with stuff. And I think I've always done that. I've always found a way of using of stuff to continue the process of looking, because looking you have to do something to look. It's an active thing, And when you talk to students about drawing and try to explain, it's not really about the drawing, it's about looking. That's the thing. The drawing is the discipline that allows you to look at something closely.
I want the other layer that maybe hasn't, if you don't know the project, is not so clear maybe yet, is the layer of the relationships of the community and the relationships of the collaborations and the collaborators, I should say, the collaborators who you might speak to that and that there were involved as the base relationships were with the Fourth Arts Block. They were the ones who we went to say, we want to site this project, we need a space for Terry. That led us to La Mama, to working within Millennium Film Workshop, which was a space in transition. I mean, that organization has been in the basement of La Mama for 45 years. And so then there was a collaborator of working with Terry's, like, I want to work on the outside of these surfaces, and what's the best way for us to do that? So Republic Worldwide, Jason Patrick Vogel, who is a wheat paste street artist who has sort of a crew that he works with to realize pieces like this, and then the other partners with the other sites. So that, I think, is an important layer.
It's great, because when Jason got there with the team, some of the team working there are all well-known street artists, with all kinds of different names. They've got kind of strange names. I don't know what they can't really be called, but I knew them as Ian and Philip. But they're this extraordinary. They're great guys. And I said to them, "Do you do much of this?" And having told us how confident they were at doing it, everyone said, "We've done nothing like this before." This kind of scale. So for everybody, it was a kind of learning process. I think that part of that collaboration is really important. Actually, I enjoy that most of all. I think that working with people and finding how to do things is probably it's the unseen bit, but the most interesting bit of working.
How about the every day that you would walk through the art
archaeological sort of, you know, you were here in New York, you're walking through the city. How was the influences of the city, the physical spaces where you were working, like in the basement, the light, you know, you were walking through, you'd come down every day, walk through Millennium, sort of explosion of what was happening to them. Talk a bit more about that, how it influenced you. I mean, you were within a very particular environment with the British Museum, and you were once again placed in a particular kind of environment here.
Well, it's very similar with the British Museum. You know, I mean, I was exhausted in that project, and I'd get home at night, and I'd be absolutely shattered, fall asleep, wake up the next morning, drag myself onto the tube, you know, get to, you know, to Holborn Station, you know, and struggle up the escalators. And bit by bit, as I got nearer and nearer, I got more and more energy. So by the time I actually got to the British Museum, I was running up the stairs. and the same thing happened here. Staying in Harlem, down to number 6, get to Astor Place, walk through, go to 7-Eleven, get a cup of coffee, it was horrible, but that's what you get. Maybe a sandwich or something, and get into the space. It was dark through the Millennium with Ray, you know, from Millennium, and the floors were covered with bits of paper and cameras and projectors. It was like wonderful, actually, the wandering through this, I don't know what you call it. And then you just massive stuff into this space. It's dark, we had lights, but kind of, in fact, you can't see how dark it actually is. You get used to it. Put my BlackBerry into a light which could amplify the sound. What I felt like, actually, I felt like, you know those journalists that go in the part of a war and they're embedded into something? I felt like an embedded artist, you know, that I'm in this situation, you know, totally involved in it, totally involved in that process. And again, learning how to do this was part of the fun, learning how to make this drawing this big. Not knowing, you know, I remember reassuring you that I knew what I was doing, but I didn't know what to do.
The inherent tension in the project.
Yeah, right? Don't worry, you know, but I know what I'm doing. And you knew what I was lying, I knew what I was lying, but it seemed better than...
Maybe he didn't,
yeah,
Terry.
Yeah, okay.
Maybe he didn't know he was lying. You shouldn't have mentioned that.
No.
That was more the fact. How much do you factor in?
Turn us off a bit.
Yeah.
But it's... But I think what I really enjoyed about doing this project was also, it was like creating a kind of Renaissance studio.
Right.
We did it that way, you know. It wasn't like getting a projector, projecting on the wall and drawing around with it. Mm-hmm. It was that making the drawing bit by bit. Mm-hmm. And having a great team of interns and helpers and supporters, and Amy and over and everyone's in there at one point or other, drawing and making stuff. Mm-hmm. And it was fantastic to kind of get that involved in rediscovering how it must have been done in a Renaissance time in Let's Go Studios. And the drawings also reminded me of what it must have been like for those Greek designers and architects to look at a plant and draw this plant and work out how to make this plant work. Mm. So there's a part of deconstruction that happens when you re-look at something. Because you start to relive how they must have seen it, how they must have understood that thing as well. And then you realise that there's no difference between what we're doing now and what we're doing in 1100 or 1300. It's the same process of trying to discover how things work.
I'll move to point. It's funny you should mention archaeology, because that's one of the things that I was going to ask Terry about. And again, this is me going back to the original project, slightly my role. But the British Museum project seemed to be very much about archaeology. It was about digging in and finding something within the walls, especially in that context. It was, you know, the things around us in the galleries had come about through a process of archaeology. They'd been rediscovered. And the kind of small project that we did together that came out of Capital, where we collected various things that had kind of turned up in this abandoned gallery and kind of re-envisaged them in a kind of false narrative. Kind of just a little kind of showcase, but it was again a kind of process of archaeology and misreading archaeology. And again, it just seems this project is slightly different in that even when your project disappeared, when it disappeared from the British Museum, that was an archaeological process as well. It was a chipping away, it was a taking away to discover what was underneath. And this project, I guess, it's more about an effacing of something. It's about the ephemeralness. There's an ephemerality about both projects, but the kind of, in a way, the thinness of something can then be kind of wiped clean. Mm. It only has a very short life. These facades have been painted over or taken away. They're gone, and I just wondered if that was something that you were kind of conscious of, that difference, or because I know that you're in lots of your drawing is a kind of scraping back and then applying layers, scraping back, applying. And again, is that something that you think about when you work, or is it something that's just a kind of post, a reading after the fact?
I'm not sure. It's something I've always done. I always do that. I think I've always found that interesting, the material. I mean, I've done all kinds of projects and all kinds of buildings and museums around the world, different places. And the information that is least interesting to me is the history of the place. Yeah. So that's, to me, anecdotal. So if I'm working in a building and they say, well, this should be a screen building, or I don't know, a screen here, it doesn't really interest me that. What interests me is the building itself, the physicality, the columns, the walls, the seat floors, those kind of things. They're the things that really I need. Yeah. The ephemeral part of it, I've always loved that fact. Of the last, I don't know, 16, 17 years of making these installations, there's only three pieces that actually still exist. All of them were meant, were designed to be destroyed. Mm-hmm. The only two that still exist are by accident, really. And with this project too, I talked to Jason about the wheat pasting stuff. The paper, was in the way we pasted it to the wall was temporary. It couldn't last. Mm-hmm. And I quite like that process. I like the investment of time and energy in something that isn't gonna last. Mm-hmm. And, I've never been interested in any kind of monumental. I'm interested in monumental scale, I think, but I'm not interested in monuments. Mm-hmm. Leaving anything. I'm very happy for things to be destroyed. And disappear.
But the chalk drawing is still there.
The top one?
No. So the inside, the chalk,
the white chalk on the black.
Is that still there?
I think so.
Well, that one's still there. The mum's still there.
Did you walk by?
Today, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's pinning away, but you thought, but I thought we'd be gone. I was just going to show you this where it used to be, and it's still there.
I think some of these things are, they're just up until they program the next something else, so they have a sort of indeterminate lifespan in a way. Yeah. Well, I want to open it up to questions, but I wondered if you wanted to, we were sort of talking about this, but your desire to revisit capital, talking of works that don't last, what was it that compelled you, what interested you in coming back to that notion of capital now? I mean, that's almost 20 years later.
I think because for the same similar reason for the first one, was that capital, looking at what's happening in Greece, where this issue came from, how the economy's been crushed, by capitalism. It's been crushed by, the kind of the bankruptcy of ideology within the capitalist system that says that somehow it's the need for profit is the engine of innovation. Mm-hmm. And that's not true, that's not how it works. But that's what we're told in how it works, that we need to have this system in order to think. So the idea of a broken capital, the idea of a capital that disintegrates, was quite important. I quite like that if it began to disintegrate while we were doing it, I quite like that as well.
To what extent do you expect people to read into that?
I don't know if you can. I mean, sometimes you make things because you have to make them and they're important to you.
Yeah.
I think to make a, I don't know how you can critique a culture and ideology through an artwork anyway. Mm-hmm. You can at least mention it. And, I think in today's moment there was a piece by Bruce Nauman of kind of I-beams with chairs coming off them. And I've always been, I love his work, but I've never been quite sure about these things. And I looked at the blurb about him, and it said that he made these things in a reaction to the fact of the torture that had been going on. Mm-hmm. a torture of criminal political prisoners, and rather than having chairs tortured. And so, you know, I think people, you know, artists do, people do want to record that we're not happy with something, that this isn't right in some way. And whether we can change the world or not, I don't know. But I think that you kind of want to do that in some way. You want to kind of at least open a debate about whether or not, you know, it's a great system that we have.
Should we open up to questions? Are there questions?
Yeah, I just had two questions about the British Museum thing. Why did they do it?
Why did they do it?
Yeah, well, why did they agree to do it? Yeah, why did they agree to do it?
Why did they? Because they thought it was, because I guess they thought it was easier to say, yeah, okay, because I would have played with them a bit. You know, I would have gone on asking. And I might have gone to talk to the director of the British Museum. Uh-huh. And, you know, and that would have been just awkward. So they said, yeah, do it, but just don't bother us.
And then you said that you had a closing party. Does that mean eventually people got to see it?
Yeah, well, yes, that was the other thing. We did get to the point where once it was established it was safe for people to go in there, then the plaster wasn't going to, you know, there wasn't plaster falling off the walls on people, or there weren't any kind of large lumps of plaster that they could pick up and drop on their heads. Then it was kind of seen as kind of okay. You couldn't tramp around in plaster dust.
Did
I think
it become
there was
a very hot thing to see?
Big time.
No one did it there. My 12 friends, no one else knew it was there, really.
But you got a review of it in Time Out, which was kind of amazing at the time. To
yeah,
get this thing that didn't really exist.
Mm-hmm. And the radio, too. I think the thing is, I remember you used to tell me that the director had sort of suddenly found this out.
Yes.
And wanted to stop it.
No, there was a point being we wanted to stop.
And then when they went on the radio, on the Time Out, and the press thing, so suddenly, and the great thing about the British is most successful at is that if they have a problem and they don't want to deal with it, they want to kill it, they simply ignore it.
Yes.
So they let it kind of run its, we're kind of good at that in Britain, I'm just thinking, kind of going, yeah, it's fine, you know, but not feeding it.
Yeah.
Because they knew if they had tried to stop it, it would cause more than anything.
I mean, there's been. I think it was just after there had been an exhibition by a curator. Somebody who was kind of slightly marginal in the curatorial process had just had an official exhibition inviting artists in to work in the Egyptian collection, and it was that exhibition, though it was sanctioned, was not. It wasn't very popular because it seemed to be engaging the museum in a field that it didn't really want to get into contemporary art. And then when I came along and suggested this thing, he said, oh, I thought, no, God, not more of that. You know, listen, we're going to get that wrong.
There's a big room now where there are things flying in the air and they're from all different artists, you know,
It has changed. There has been a change of culture, a change of director and a change of culture there. So there have been many more artist installations. There have been some very successful ones. Grace and Perry did a very, very popular kind of artist choice sort of exhibition where he kind of recurated galleries within the British Museum. Howard Hodgkinson has shown his own collection of Indian miniatures and things like that. So there has been a shift, but this was...
The one I'm thinking of, I just remembered, is the entrance to those 19th century galleries. There's a big room before with things all over.
Not the B&A? You're thinking of?
You know, the with all the Napoleonic stuff, it looks like a gallery from the 19th century.
The Gallery of the Enlightenment.
Yes, that's it, outside of that.
Yeah, I can't think what that is, but yes, possible.
It's a museum not only of archaeology, but also of stolen property.
Yeah. I have a question for those of you who came. Your experience of the exhibition itself, I'm curious to hear what your thoughts are, because I have something in mind wondering if it translates. I'm wondering if the a magnitude of the amount of work that Terry actually did is sort of reflected in what we've put up. Are you able to travel through and understand the different sites of the project? Is that even important or not? I'm just kind of curious. Does anyone have any?
Well, in a way, it couldn't be because there were these three that scale, which was, that was a squeeze to give because they've got the rafters there, which cut it especially to thin. So we couldn't have shown all the stuff. You know, I did joke about the fact that maybe we would have taken the upstairs show and put it down here, upstairs, but that didn't go down too well. But it was hard. We didn't know what to do, whether to make this kind of really busy show, packed full of things, or just to show bits of stuff, like most shows, you can. There's infinite amounts of ways of doing it.
Mm. And it's not meant as a kind of a reconstruction of your studio, really, it's tempting to do that because obviously that was the site of all that activity and all that work and those hours and hours. And you feel as if that should be represented, but an exhibition is a different thing from a studio, doesn't it? It's a different space.
I think there's a question on the stairs and then...
Oh, I was just going to respond to that problem and say that the range of media that's represented shows a pretty in-depth process, and especially reading the typewritten things, you can see that you've been dwelling on it for quite some time and are reflecting and really, really considering, and then also formally details. But I was excited to hear about the blue tape and the abstract. I think that's interesting, also. Addition.
I think it's something I've dealt with a lot in my, because they were being destroyed, I never quite sure what to do with the documentation of that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the first projects in Leytonstone where I just took over these spaces, I documented only just as kind of record, but last minute stuff.
Photographs, yeah.
Yeah,
that was it.
Yeah. I didn't think what I would even look at them in the beginning,
yeah,
but just
yeah.
Like just a record. And then later on, I began to realize that actually, I get slide talks and stuff that were useful to kind of talk about the work. But I've never known quite what to do with those photographs because to me, they're not the work, they're just photographs of the work. But I've always wanted to do something. I did another project actually in South London, which was in a house next to the museum. And again, that project was made as a photograph because I knew it was a very dangerous place to get into.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I mean, it was full of pigeon shit. It was full of staircases that were wobbly. And you couldn't. I mean, it was very dangerous to work in this space.
You did the same similar project in Tate Modern.
Tate Modern, yes,
yeah.
True.
Yeah.
I got invited to make this project as it's been renovated into Tate Modern. And so we talked to them, and they said, "Well, we have to kind of, I think, get a mobile phone. It's 1996. It's big phone, and the battery lasted 4 hours. I mean, it was ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah.
It lasted a day.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the idea was that I would actually ring up the tape, but it was a tape Britain, with the tape, and they'd send somebody down to unlock, let me in, and then they go out, and I had to ring up and say I'm finished, and they'd come down and let me out again." And I tried to say, "Well, I have no idea, I don't know, I might have been in a mood that day, I don't know how I'm going to do that." So after lots of negotiations, eventually they gave me the keys. On the condition that I could take anybody else into that space, and I couldn't have a party in there.
I wouldn't.
I broke all those.
Yeah. You have a party?
You didn't invite me. Well, we invited, yeah, okay, sorry about that. We did, but it was, I know that space, I must admit, I it's in my studio for 3 months, I think it was, about that space. And again, it was quite dangerous place to be, because there was a floor missing and there's kind of gaps and stuff. But most of my friends are used to that kind of stuff anyway, so it wouldn't be a problem.
And you said, whenever anybody came round, you said, bring a screwdriver. There's all sorts of good things to...
Yeah, I stole a lot from that. I stole from everything. Every project I do, I steal something from the project. So...
So,
I know what you took.
Yeah, okay.
I think I do. The elephant photograph.
I didn't take that.
Do you know the one I mean?
Yeah. The picture of the elephant in the back room on the
back stairway when you came from the La Mama lobby downstairs, like you were going in to see a film at Millennium, and they had several really great black and white photos just attached onto the wall, and one of them was an elephant I loved. I would go by it and go.
And it disappeared.
I confess.
I thought you took it.
No, I didn't. Anyway,
okay. So the British Museum had all the furniture, the door furniture, handles, things. I've still got them actually. I actually showed them once. It's stolen property.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. You know, in a gallery, it was just a stolen property from the Tate and a little door handle.
Well, the front of the number plate from our house is from Tate Modern.
That's right, yeah.
Actually, one, two, nine.
Those works that you only took, that you were just describing, that you only took just those snapshots at the end, right?
The first project, yeah.
Yeah, the first project. So then they just existed as stories? Hmm.
And photographs. I mean, just as photographs.
But mainly, like, and okay, so they were stories, and so the stories and those works kept then feeding into the next thing, which then you did more documentation.
Yeah, I mean, I got better at photographing it, but I didn't know why. I mean, I was just so I recognized better take these pictures.
Right.
And as I got invited to do talks and things, I kind of used them to kind of illustrate the talk and that stuff.
Yeah.
And then I got to the point where I was getting more and more. If it's a bigger show, so I thought I would make bigger pictures of the things.
Mm-hmm.
But I was never that good at it, really. I kept trying to, and friends like Richard Wilson would do a show together in back in Barcelona.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd take a few shots of my piece, and it had been a whole day with big cameras taking shots. So I didn't really do it really well. And then one show I did in Mexico, where I made a piece of staples. I think it's probably the best piece I made with staples. And I forgot to photograph it completely. Just completely forgot. So it's one piece that's never been documented. And I quite like that, actually.
I do too, I applaud that. I mean, there's like something like, okay, you and whoever else decides to witness it at that moment.
Yeah, I think that's part of it for me too, mm-hmm. that it's, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So calling this show document was interesting because I had this question that I'm not sure how to answer it, was
mm-hmm.
how important is the document?
Mm-hmm.
Because so many shows where they presented the documentation if it was the work,
mm-hmm.
In fact, I did a show in the gallery, and I had some photographs of these early installations. I thought I'd tell you one. And I remember the gallery people, and we kind of priced everything, the drawings and everything. And actually, it's a solo show, but I call it group show, because there's so many different groups of things in it. And they said to me, oh, we sold one of those photographs. And I was so shocked that they sold it, because I didn't think anyone would buy it. I only priced it out just to keep them amused. I assume that you would actually want to buy a photograph.
Al Dedge, businessman.
I take lessons. But I didn't know what to do. So, and then I actually wasn't sure what to do. So I kind of said, well, can we buy it back? Because I just didn't want that to be in the world. Because it wasn't really, it was documentation, it wasn't the thing. And I'm still struggling with that because I still think, well, I've got that money, so I've got to find a way that I'm going to live.
That's
maybe,
what I was going to ask you.
Well, maybe that's so you can do that. I think you can find a way of making a photograph that is just something different to what the work is. And then I think that's a valid piece of work. I looked at someone like Marina Abramovich has made these big black and white photographs,
mm-hmm.
these kind of grainy pictures of her work, and you can see what she's doing. She's kind of a back catalogue or something, and they're big photographs, but they're interesting. And they're big, and a museum might buy them, and then the money goes back into her foundation, and the foundation acts up to do good things. So there's a good reason to make these things work.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to do that. I want a foundation. I just want to pay the rent, but I mean, I kind of, it would be nice to find a way of doing something that I'm proud of, that I'm happy to go out in the world and represent what I do.
Colette had a question.
Well, there's two things. That was my first question was when we were talking. Sorry, I have a little laryngitis. I was here and I saw the installation pieces on the street. And I was on the tour and I got Terry's before that. But it was very interesting for me to think about how he was going to document that memory here. And I was really, I think it's great. I mean, to me, it really translated really well. And I'm much better than I even could imagine. I couldn't imagine. I was kind of curious to see how he would do it.
Well, I'm not there yet. I mean, this is his Cam's best guess at it. I mean, I'm not quite sure how.
But I don't know anything about this one.
Because Cam did that all. I'm not sure how to document this project. I thought we planned it to be
Right. Yeah, well, that's why I was saying this work, because when I saw the tour, to me it was a lot about the process. Seeing, right? So much of it in a way. And then how were you going to bring that in?
I think that if I was going to do this, I will do at some point, we show this work.
Right.
I think I would show these pieces much bigger, but single on a wall.
Mm.
So it'd almost be a kind of wall size piece. So if you had the first piece the size of a wall, the second one the size of a wall. Mm. So actually you've got a much closer connection with it. That might be the way to go with it, rather than try and reassemble it.
But presumably there is some sort of film documentation of the pieces.
There's only one piece, which was Chuck Smith took.
So that was another layer.
By the way, on our website, we have a video gallery, and that will be starting on July 1st. We'll have that posted there. So it's a time-lapse film of you working.
That was outside Isle of Glass, and Chuck was one of the. I mean,
Chuck lived across the street.
Yeah, I've never been in the street like it. It's like the perfect ideal street, actually. Everyone knows each other there. Every day we try and work there, you spend half the time discussing the project that the women's walking past with their dogs or their kids or whatever.
That's right, you get so frustrated. Terry had a box. It was a studio in a box, and he'd walk from site to site with all the gear in the box, and the box gets all tattered and his paint splattered, and he'd grumble, "Would you just stand here for a few minutes so that the next person doesn't go by, you can answer the question so I can actually get some work done?"
No,
they're
tracking,
weren't
they?
Yeah.
I mean,
that film got made.
It's
Chuck just walked by.
Right? Yeah, well,
somebody that you
do. Yeah, I know. They just said, "Do you like to film it?" Sure. And so he came along every time he was there. About an hour time. And it was so trusting because he had his camera stuck on the tripod on the other side of the street. Because it'd take like a time lapse thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then he'd just simply wander off and have a chat to me or somebody else, let's hang about that, leave his camera there.
Very safe city, New York.
But then on the third street, the next block up, which was this piece here, we had the men's homeless shelter and meth lab, not lab.
Really?
Where you exchange, your needles, and we had that whole crew who were out there every day, kind of going, "Hey, can we give you a hand? Can we give you a hand?" And they were awesome because they were just sort of like, "Well, what you doing? What's going on?" And they'd be across the street playing b-ball, and then they'd come over and take their smokes, and that was a whole other great kind of engagement.
They were so key to keep we engaging every day. We had them engaging with them all the time, kind of. And because I had no idea what we were going to do. They kept giving suggestions. You could do an eagle. And I remember we found two-thirds of the way through this.
Yeah.
That disappointment was so evident. It wasn't a lucky eagle or anything.
Well, the idea is
like a cabbage.
Go across the street. Go back. Step back.
It's an acanthus leaf.
But that layer of sort of the dialogue or the silent dialogue too visually that was at play over the course of... So, this had a whole other, both the ideal glass and the back of the mama had other drawings on them before, and we painted them out as a signal to the neighborhood, okay, something's about to change, and we left that for like a week to see if there would be a response, if there would be something, some kind of dialogue going on.
You know, there were just a few, I noticed that you covered up your favorite. But underneath, there's, you know, there were a few tags.
Yeah.
But it was really interesting because it was kind of visually quiet for the most part. And then Terry starts working, and then the dialogue between the residents of the street with Terry as he's working. And so that was another...
You talked about the graffiti a lot, actually, at the beginning of the project, too, about kind of the history of graffiti and the street art.
And in that particular neighborhood, it's a strong presence, and we wanted to be respectful of these surfaces changing. And Ideal Glass was a surface that I think the neighborhood was used to changing out quite periodically. But this piece on the back of La Mama had been there for quite a while, and it was a beloved piece. So people weren't touching it. They weren't, you know, tagging it. So we were a little bit sensitive. We were sensitive to the fact that something, it might disrupt something and what the response would be. So
it hasn't been tagged, but it's been splashed with something. It hasn't been tagged. And I think the more I thought about the street art, the graffiti art, because it's also in London too, is it? Where, and I never really thought about it before. But kind of half a mile, the fact that the energy of someone just out the street, well, the more I looked at that kind of this kind of bulbous thing, the kind of spray, and like, I got really tired of it. This is what I did when I was 16. Mm. You know, big A's and B's. I just would like to do a project with them and say, you know, you can do stuff in the street, but it's got to be a bit more dangerous than this. Because this can't go wrong. I mean,
you're doing it all wrong. Yeah.
You paint an A that's kind of
good
like fat A on it. I mean, it's not, never, it's, and I think that sense of risk, you know, is important. And I think it'd be great to say, look, you know, great, do things on this, but do it more edgy. Mm. Do stuff that might foul is more interesting.
Yeah.
I'm trying to get another kiss this one.
Well, with that call to arms, just say thank you very much, Terry. It's been really a wonderful pleasure working with you, and a pleasure to have you here tonight, and thank you, Colin.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you all for coming. Yeah.